Hello, welcome to the Travel Advice Show. Listen as travel experts Chris Newton and Jerry Fuller give advice on world destinations and discuss important travel topics that are valuable to any world traveler. Go to www.traveladviceshow.com where you can listen to this show and all previous shows, or even ask your travel questions. Now here are your hosts, Chris and Jerry.
Hi, welcome to the Travel Advice Show, and we're talking about Iceland today, the unique and exciting adventures on Iceland. And I'm Chris Newton, one of the co-hosts, and my other co-host, Jerry Fuller. How you doing, Jerry?
Phenomenal. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing good, Jerry. Thank you. Yeah, would you like to introduce our guest today? Yeah.
I really would. I've known about their company, and Travel Advice has recommended their company a long time, for many years. And we love and very excited about having Holly Nelson, who is director of sales and sales director of a company that has two names, actually, Iceland Adventure and Horses North. And welcome, Holly. We're really excited that you're here with us.
Thank you. The pleasure is mine entirely.
Oh, could no. I ask one question very quickly on
sure.
why there are two names to your company?
Yeah, it really, it's sort of the evolution of the both our approach to sales and a little bit of our specialties. When we started in 97, we were really focusing on selling riding tours in Iceland because there's a unique breed of horse there that is a wonderful way to see the landscape. And the business really came out of our own experience with the horses. And so we started up this little company selling horse tours, which was successful in a very miniature way. And then at a certain point, we realized that lots of people wanted to do stuff in addition to riding horses. So we broadened out our approach to both what we were selling and what we were getting to do first in Iceland as a basis for sales. And that's when we created Iceland Adventure. And so now mostly we go by the name Iceland Adventure, although our beginnings are really with the Icelandic horses.
Oh, okay. Very good. Could we ask this question? When is the best time to go? Is there really a best time, or does it matter when you go to Iceland? Because, I mean, the name itself, well, maybe I better start this way after doing answering that question, because most people really don't know much about Iceland. And could you explain some of the best times to go and why, and what it sort of overview geography, what it looks like? Because I've been about 10 or 13 times something, and it's phenomenal. But would you explain a little bit about Iceland? It's really not Greenland.
Sure. It's a good question. And we get the question all the time about when's the best time to go to Iceland. And it's a little bit of a trick. It's a trick question, or perhaps just a trick answer. Because if you're looking for, you know, great weather and sunshine and cheap prices, then the answer is never. Because that's something that doesn't happen in Iceland. The weather can be dodgy at best any time, but it always has a unique, you know, that the unique sort of landscape and location and kind of perspective of the Icelanders is always there. The bulk of the people we work with, and we work with people from mostly North America, but certainly Asia and Europe and Africa a little bit as well, most people tend to go in the summer months of sort of June, July, and August. Increasingly a fair amount also in May and September, because what happens then is that the sun is up around the clock, or nearly so.
Mm.
On our very first trip there, back in the mid-90s, early 90s, we were there from middle of July till our last night in Iceland was August 4th, and that was the night in which it got dark enough for a star to come out. And it was, you know, kind of exciting for us because we'd been riding for 10 days and we hadn't seen any dark except for a little bit of this sort of, you know, kind of rosy twilight at between 2 and 4 in the morning. So that, excuse me, June, July, and August really have the midnight sun and the benefits of it, meaning you can go out and have fun sort of all night long and usually get to sleep. And the other side of the coin is that in the winter months, which are also, well, the weather is incrementally less good, put it that way. But on a snowy day in Iceland, there's nothing really much more beautiful than that, a snowy, sunny day, you know, where the snow is coming down and the sun is glistening off it. It's really quite spectacular. And you have the Northern Lights in the, from about October to, reliably October to April. We've seen them as early as August, I think 22nd we've seen them. But they're around a lot. You just have to have a clear night. And sort of because of where Iceland is on the globe and the weather patterns in that part of the world, it's clear nights are really kind of a precious thing. You don't have them in spades. There's not a lot of them because there's a lot of overcast. But when it is clear, there they are, and it's quite spectacular. And let me just touch on the Iceland question, because everybody asked that one too. Even though Iceland is very close to the Arctic Circle, there is, in fact, an island up off the town of Akureyri called Grimsey Island that the Arctic Circle goes right through, literally right through somebody's house and right down to the middle of the island itself. And so everything is quite far north, but because of the Gulf Stream, it really is quite, I'm not going to say warm, but not nearly as cold as you'd expect up there. It's pretty temperate, in fact. In January, the average temperature in Reykjavik, which is the capital city, is about 31 degrees. It's frequently compared to Washington, D.C. So that's kind of astounding. Jerry, I don't know if you've been there in the winter.
I have. Only once, but I have.
Yeah.
I was amazed that it's not as cold as what people think, at least when I was there. I was there in February, early February on my birthday, which is 3rd of February.
Okay.
And, I really thought I was going to the North Pole before I went.
Yeah.
And I was stunned that it was not tropical, but it was nothing like I expected.
It's quite, the weather in that part of the world is changeable under any circumstances, but the winter is always quite surprising. I frequently go up in February to see some people and do a few things. And a couple years ago, I was there for a couple of days, and it was sort of, 38, a little overcast, nothing really wintry. And then I went to bed late one night, as is typical when I'm up in Iceland. And, 3 o'clock in the morning, there's no snow. And when I had to roll out the next morning at 8:30, there's a foot and a half of snow on the ground. And part of me started
like,
where does this come from? And for the next couple of days, it was extremely coldy and windy. I went out on a really neat caving expedition with a bunch of people out on Hetley Safety Moor, just above Reykjavik. And it was sunny, but snow blowing so ferociously, I thought I was going to freeze to death. I mean, it was that sort of, I'm with a group of about 8 or 10 other people, and we're sort of walking along, like holding hands, because the guy in front of us knows where we're going. And it was that kind of a whiteout condition.
Wow.
So you get the extremes. But mostly you get the sort of gray middle in the winter. And in the summer, you may have some nice sunny days, but you'll typically have weather in the 50s or 60s. And we always tell people, really what you want to prepare for is weather that's changeable. The Icelanders say they don't have weather, they have commercials for weather. because you'll start out and it'll be sunny, and then there'll be some wind coming up, and then a few raindrops, and then that'll blow away, and the clouds will come back, and then the sun will come back, and then it'll be time for lunch. And it really does change that quickly. So it means anything you're going to do in Iceland, outdoors, you want to be prepared for the next weather system, so that you want to dress in layers. But you don't have to dress like in Arctic layers mostly. Most of the year you're fine in just good sort of three-season clothing. Yeah, we describe the weather as autumnal, even in times like April and May.
How easy is it to travel to Iceland,
that's one of the interesting questions that we get asked quite a bit. Now, it depends. Iceland's being sort of, it's being marketed pretty nicely by the Iceland Tourist Board these days, so that people are starting to see it sort of in the back of their consciousness. And it's astounding, really, that if you're in Boston, which I know you guys aren't, but people are, or they can get there, from Boston it's less than a five-hour flight. Iceland Air flies out of Boston, Minneapolis, and JFK. And then this spring they'll be opening gateways from Toronto and Halifax. So from the northeast or the northern part of the U.S., it's a very easy trip. And it's actually, once you get there, it's a pretty pleasant place to travel around. I mean, there's a lot of things that take, there's a lot of places where you benefit from a little bit of expertise, as I'm sure you found, Jerry, your return trips get easier. Because you know a little bit more about it. And it's a little bit, oh, well, the language can at best be called mysterious, but it's quite, you know, generally people speak excellent English, almost everybody. Signs are easy to read and pretty clear. It's not a super touristy place, but it's certainly designed to make visitors feel welcome so that you don't need shots, you don't need a visa. You just, as they say, as we say, you don't need a visa, a MasterCard will do. because it can be a little bit, it just hit the, it hit the list that the UN developed, the UN released a list showing that Iceland had the highest standard of living in the world, and they also showed that it's the most expensive place in the world to live, so that it does tend to be a little bit pricey, so you probably want a visa and a MasterCard. And that's the other element is that everybody in Iceland takes plastic because they do have visitors a lot, so that they have their sweet little Icelandic krona, which really isn't available anywhere outside of Iceland, that's fine. You know, get some once you're there. You certainly don't want to pay a premium to pick them up here, and they're always available. You know, the local currency is always available once you get to Iceland. So it's an easy place, you know.
Okay.
If it helps if you know what you planned ahead of time. And I should add that it's an easy place to travel around. It's not a place that we ever recommend showing up and just saying, well, I'll get something worked out once I'm there. Because I should add that part.
Right.
You know, there's lots of places in the world where you can pick up a car and kind of go from B&B to B&B. Like I'm thinking of Ireland, where it's such a pleasure to travel around, and there's lots of cozy little places that, you know, if one's full, the next one's down the street's available. And Iceland is not like that. In the summer, even though it's not that it gets crowded, they have a kind of a shortage of facilities for visitors, so that things get filled up, and particularly out in the countryside, if the hotel in the area is filled, you may have a long distance to go before you have another option. So we never, off-season there's a lot more flexibility, particularly in the winter, not such a problem. But in the summer, June, July, and August, it can be very challenging to find accommodation. So once you get there, it's easy, but make sure you've got stuff planned out before you get there. Because otherwise you'll spend all your time looking for places to stay and on rare occasions, you know, sleeping in the car. But once you're there, Iceland's got lots of stuff going on. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to, while we were talking about places to stay, I know they have a variety of options, like guest houses and hotels. Do you want to spend just a few minutes on some of those options?
Sure. Yeah, and that's because that's one of the things, Jerry, that we've seen develop pretty nicely in the, we're in our 10th year now. There's quite a nice range of accommodations that when we were first getting started in the Iceland tour operator business, the options were a lot more limited. The capital, Reykjavik, which is really the only city of any size in the country, has about 110,000 people. And just for comparison, the second biggest city is Akureyri, and it's only 15,000. So Reykjavik's really the only game in town, or the only town in town, so to speak. It has become a very cosmopolitan city in a lot of ways. It's not like the other Scandinavian capitals that have a lot of grand and glorious old buildings, but it has a lot of sort of interesting modern architecture. Not a lot. It has some. It has a few old buildings, a nice little harbor. And these days, it's really developed a name for interesting hotels and great restaurants, so that there's now they're all pretty much Iceland-based. Hilton opened a hotel, took over one of the Icelandair hotels this spring, and that's the first time that one of the American-based hotel groups has really gotten based in Iceland.
Mm.
And it's a five-star hotel. There's a couple of other four-star hotels. There's five of them. But then there's plenty of other interesting sort of three-star hotels. And because it's Scandinavia, they all meet a certain kind of standard. You know, they're clean. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, very unusual occasions where things aren't up to standards, and the Icelanders won't put up with that very much. So that you get these comfortable hotels, not fancy, and the rooms aren't big, but they're clean, and they come with a nice breakfast so that you can really, like, fuel up. There's
mm-hmm.
also, both in the city and a lot more in the countryside, a lot of quite interesting guest houses and farm accommodations. And we work with those quite a bit they tend to be fairly small, you know, often no bigger than 10 or 12 rooms, but they offer a real opportunity to meet both fellow visitors and other Icelanders, or Icelanders. Your hosts will be often farmers that do this in the summer and concentrate on their sheep in the winter and that sort of stuff. So that there's a nice a nice way to kind of get your feet on the ground in the little towns and the countryside. You don't end up feeling sort of like you're isolated in some big hotel chain.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, we don't market a lot of this, but there's also, if you've got good gear, there's also plenty of camping. The Icelanders are big campers, and a lot of them on the weekends, the campgrounds will be filled. And if you're really a sort of a rugged individualist and want to take your gear or rent gear once you're there, there's plenty of places up in the highlands that are just spectacular campsites, sort of as beautiful as any place you'll ever see. You do have to go with good wind pegs because the wind can be a real issue, as well as the rain. But it's all, you know, as part of our job is to educate people that, you know, the weather is just part of the adventure.
Mm-hmm. And that's what makes it so neat, because I know, talking about the adventure and the culture, one of the trips that I took up there, I basically went hiking, trekking, and walking. And we went fishing in the rivers and spent about 4 days, a guide and two other people and I, going through the center part of the country.
Oh, cool.
And,
up in the highlands.
Yes. And what I'm talking about is what a lot of people, I think, don't understand is Iceland is an extremely outdoor adventure. It's really a hidden gem for people who like outdoors. And you're mentioning some of the exciting things that can happen when you're camping. And I know we were camping as we did this trek. And you talk about wind and rain, and sometimes it can be really a lot of fun. But that's part of it. Do you want to spend some time talking about some of the wild and exciting adventures, things that you can do while you're there? Because one thing that most people don't understand, you can actually see whales.
Yeah. That's one of the quite unique things. And, you know, I'm glad you bring this up, Jerry, because really Iceland is about the outdoors. I mean, and don't get me wrong, Reykjavik is a very interesting city, and it's got some interesting cultural aspects to it.
And it's really got the nightlife, too.
Yeah, and I can't say enough about the food.
I know.
Because it's really wonderful.
Yes.
But the real Iceland is about 20 minutes outside the capital when you get up to Hellisheiði, or you get out to Reykjanes Peninsula, or you go up towards Snæfellsnes. There's the countryside, which is sort of very much shaped by the volcanic eruptions over the years, as well as sort of glacial and water action. The countryside is there's a great sort of variety of shapes and sizes and colors. It's really beautiful, even in overcast light. And that's what I think really invites most people to Iceland, is a chance to get out in this landscape and explore it in all these different ways. If you were to go north of Reykjavik up to the Snæfellsnes Peninsula, which is just it's only about an hour and a half north of the countryside, in the countryside north of the city, in a little town up there called Olafsvik, there is a whale-watching cruise that you can take where they regularly see blue whales. Because the blue whales come up there for the summer, and they have to go out into the harbor, out to Breivik, a little bit to see them. And the last couple of years, they haven't been quite as certain as they were for the sort of the 10 years before that. But you also see a huge array of other kinds of whales, minkes, right whales, belugas, as well as, you know, dolphins and all kinds of other sea mammals, lots of seals and that sort of stuff. And there's also, there's whale watching actually from a bunch of different parts of the country. You can take a whale watching cruise right from Reykjavik. There's a choice of cruise ships down at the old harbor that'll, that go out usually three times a day in the summer. And they also go to, most of them go to Puffin Island because you can see puffins by the millions. And that, those are, you know, those birds are pretty amusing. And that's, puffins are actually at the top of the list for about 80% of the people that want, they want to go to Iceland to see puffins. And you're almost, you know, if you go in the summer months, even May, you're almost certain to see them.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, there's more whaling up in the north, or whaling, whale watching. There's a town called Húsavík up in the north that really, when they stopped commercial whaling, in the 90s, Húsavík decided that they would take these whaling ships and make them do something positive with them, so they became really the first town in the country to initiate the whole whale watching thing. And it's now quite a bit around the country, but they see whales on, of some sort or another, often multiple sorts or another, on every cruise. So that's pretty neat. If you were thinking about other sort of, it sounds like the kind of Highland expedition that you did is sort of a, it's kind of a typical sort of, not typical, but it's a good example of the kind of adventure you can get, which involves a lot of things, some hiking, camping, fishing. I assume you did some, a little bit of climbing and serious walking and all that sort of stuff. And there's that kind of stuff available either as, you know, as an independent traveler like yourself, there's plenty of excellent Icelandic companies that will take you out and guide you on that sort of stuff. And we work with a bunch of different outfitters that most of whom, I mean, anybody that we work with, they really know their stuff and they're good at it and they tend to have a fairly sort of a pretty deep knowledge of the landscape they're working in. So you get a, you get guides that know both the geological history of the landscape as well as the cultural stuff. And there's lots of stories. I don't know if you heard any of those, Jerry, about and all kinds of stories about the landscape and the supernatural beings that have lived there.
Yes. Yeah, so it's that, almost like trolls and not really trolls, but I mean that kind of a thing and Nepicon, not really them, but that kind of thing, yes. It's
half the right, half the mountains in the Highlands are named after one troll or another.
Yeah.
and there's a pretty deeply rooted belief in beings other than humans. It goes back to the Viking days, really. There has been a documentary called Hulsfolk, which is the hidden people that's been making the rounds about the Icelanders' very firm belief in these other in these beings, and that they kind of go out of their way to take care of them because they know if they don't, they're in trouble.
And the volcanoes will get them.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, and they relate a lot of this stuff. Again, it comes back to the, you know, Iceland was really settled by the Vikings in the 9th century, and it goes back to the some of the beliefs that the Vikings brought with them, which, like a lot of things in Iceland, certain other beliefs are really unchanged from Viking times, and that's certainly one of them. You know, the Icelanders are this sort of modern group of people with more cell phones than people, and yet more horses than cars. They're, you know, it's kind of a funny little combination. But anyway, back to the adventure thing. I mean, if we send people on both tours like the one you did, as well as some escorted coach tours, either small groups or groups as large as 20, which in much of the rest of the world, that's not really a large group. So there's ways to get out in the landscape with specific guides, and there's also a fair amount of people who do self-guided driving tours. We work with people to, you know, get them booked in accommodations and give them a nice itinerary of possibilities of what they could be doing on their drive around the countryside.
Mm-hmm.
We really sort of developed these itineraries based a lot on our own travel, working with a couple of our colleagues in Iceland, and sort of pretty uniquely comprehensive, so that makes it easy for people to do whatever they want to do. So, and the problem is, like a lot of things in Iceland, there's not quite time to get to all of them.
Right.
So sometimes people have to make a few decisions. If you were, part of what's nice is, like, even if you're based in Reykjavik and just doing a few almost either day tours or short drives, if you go up to the west to the Snæfellsnes Peninsula and West Iceland, that's where you can do the whales and take these wonderful boat rides out in the harbor. There's also a lot of the Snæfellsnes, for instance, has a couple of interesting saga sites that we get a fair amount of Americans and Europeans.
Oh, before we go any farther, would you, could you hear the word saga quite a bit up there? Can you explain what that means?
It's Icelandic for story, and it's one of the few languages that have come from Icelandic into English, that and Geysir. And it's when the Vikings arrived, you know, they developed this sort of sense of culture fairly quickly. I don't want to go too deeply into it, but, you know, they were really second sons looking for farmland, and they came in and found this unpopulated, uninhabited island with, at the time, lots of good farmland. And so they sort of settled in quite quickly, and in the first couple hundred years, developed a great set of sort of cultural stories and morality tales about, you know, what happens to good people and bad people and how the hidden folk play a role in it. And in the 13th century, a guy named Snorri Sturluson collected them in the sagas, and that's really what became the basis for a whole huge portion of Nordic literature are the Icelandic sagas. And they're both stories of, you know, they can be kind of gory and vengeful and lots of sort of violence, but they're also kind of stories about how they lived, and then a certain amount of, like any saga, a certain amount of exaggeration in them. But there's a great saga center in Akranes, which is just north of Reykjavik, that focuses on one of the main ones called Eyjolf Skallagrim's saga. And I think I've got that name wrong, but it's one of it's the tales about the early days of settling the country. And it's a pretty important part of the sort of Nordic psyche in that part of the country. And then also, yeah, just a little bit north of that is Reykholt, where Snorri Sturluson, who collected the sagas, lived. And there's a really nice museum that's very impressive if you're interested in both Icelandic and medieval Scandinavian history, as well as his hot pool, because hot water is a big factor in Iceland everywhere.
Oh, is it ever?
Yeah. You know, it's part of what happens when you have volcanoes, is if you're lucky, you get hot springs along.
And there are geysers and there are hot ponds. Because we do want to spend some time on that, because...
Yeah.
And that we can go on forever on every topic, because, I mean, Iceland is really a varied country. And
it's pretty complex.
There's so many options.
Yeah.
And it's such a small country in relative size. I mean, it's not that huge, really. But you could spend months.
Yeah, that's one of the things. I mean, we always say you can drive to Akureyri, which is sort of the northern city. It's either 5 hours or 5 months, you know, and you could sort of, you can really take your time to get to it.
Yeah. Well, let's do this a minute. We want to make sure before we forget, we want to talk about the other name of your company, the Horses North, and how fabulous the horses are up there and how important they are. Do you want to spend a little bit on that before we forget, and then we'll come back to some of the fabulous things like the hot springs and kayaking and glaciers and
did you have a chance to ride the horse? Have you ever ridden horses when you were there, Jerry?
I did. I think my third trip there, I did. And it's very interesting. And I think it's mandatory. If you go to Iceland and don't do it, I think you've missed an opportunity, don't you?
Yes, I think that's a wonderful way of putting it. Because there, on our first trip there, we were riding with a bunch of people that had ridden for all of their lives, as opposed to us. And one of our friends said, at the end of our first riding day, we've been riding for 12 hours, it's 11:30 at night, and we're tearing at a madcap pace at this tolt, actually, the special gate of the Icelandic horses. We're riding up...
Now, first of all, describe the Icelandic horse.
Yeah.
Before we get into it, because it's...
Sure. They're small. They tend to be 13 or 14 hands, which is about two-thirds of the size of a normal, say, a quarter horse. An average sort of a person, as I am, if I stand up straight and put my arm out at shoulder level, that's where their back comes. And that makes them very handy to get on and off. And they're quite sturdy, though, unlike a lot of small horses that don't want to carry full-size people. The Icelandic horse is extremely stout, and there's no problem with their carrying people as of any size. They're bred to carry large people, and the Icelanders, in fact, are the largest people in the world, both in terms of height and weight. So, and because they live on a fairly rugged landscape and with a lot of wind, they have these great coats. I mean, they got lots and lots of hair, a fabulous mane. The most important thing that they have is a couple of gates that big horses used to have and don't have anymore. The one that I'm assuming you experienced was called the Tolt, and that's what most people go there for. And it's a running walk, a four-beat running walk. It's the same foot pattern as if the horse was walking, but it goes quite quickly. It's been clocked at, I think, 35 miles an hour. And it has that smooth feel of a walk where you don't have to get off the horse. Yeah, you want to keep your heels down and relax, and you just travel at this sort of in this smooth way of, you know, you stay quite level to the ground, and your head. Yeah, so if you see somebody tolting in the distance, their head is level, and it's just quite astounding. This the Icelanders will show off the tolt in terms of speed. They have contests to see who can tolt the fastest with a full mug of beer in their hand. And they're too. They like their beer too much to be willing to waste a drop of it.
So the horses are trained to accommodate.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And it is. It's so smooth and it goes so fast. Even a novice rider, as we found out on our first day there, as this friend of ours said, she said, "You know, this is what if you've never ridden before, this is what you imagine riding is like, because you don't have to post, you don't have to work too hard to keep the horse going." Which it can be a problem with Eastern horses. Sometimes you have to kind of kick them every step. You just you get on them, put your heels down, and relax, and trust the horse, and enjoy the ride. The tolt comes from it's the kind of gait that's been very useful over the years to travel over the rugged landscape that's shaped by frost and you know lots of lots of ice and you know sort of water freezing and unfreezing. So there's lots of hummocks and that sort of stuff. And it's really designed to allow people to travel comfortably over this rugged landscape for great distances. The Icelanders have never been one much for roads. They have roads now, but a good road system is really just a creature of the last 50 years. Before that, they would use their horses for everything around the farm, from plowing to riding to the neighbors, riding to town, riding to church. And the tradition was that the most important thing you needed your horses for was to go out in the fall and round up your animals and bring them home for the winter because that's what was going to feed you in the winter. They typically put their sheep out in the mountain. They still do this in most of the country. They put their sheep up in the high sort of mountain fields that are way up and quite remote. And then in the fall, they have to go and, you know, bring them home to keep them safe and to feed them and, of course, to eat them. And in order to do this, they had to have horses that their horses had to be in really good condition, and so they would start this, you know, in the middle of summer they'd get their best horses out and they'd go out on riding tours for 3 or 4 days, or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8, just to keep to start getting the horses in condition so they'd be ready for this big work. And the horses are strong and sturdy, but because the days were sometimes quite long, the tradition developed that you'd take extra horses with you. So that you would travel with a herd of loose horses to go out and gather up the animals. And that's what's sort of so unique about riding in Iceland, the both the horse and the tradition of horse touring, which is a very, it's something that's sort of, it's almost genetic in the Icelanders. It's not something they've created for visitors, which is part of what we like about it, is you go out with the Icelanders and you may ride, and then, of course, there's a great variety of riding programs. The traditional ride is sort of 8 or 9 days long, and you may ride 3 or 4 horses a day and stay in mountain huts and have great meals and spend the night, you know, perhaps drinking and singing. And you'll ride, you know, during the day with this herd of 50 or 60 loose horses. And I don't know if you had an opportunity to do that, but it's really quite unique.
It's phenomenal. It's an experience that's indescribable.
And the horses, the first time we did it, we were astounded to understand it. It taught us so much more about the kind of herd instinct of horses, because in general, the horses are happy to stick together. You have to, I mean, there's a real skill with how you set your riders and your horses up. You put your fast horses and riders in the front, slower and more relaxed horses and riders in the back, and you have this huge herd of horses in the middle. And if mm-hmm. some of them sort of cut out, somebody's job is to kind of go over and, you know, kind of push them back into the herd and at all at a fairly fast clip. And so it mm-hmm. makes for a real interesting riding experience. These days, as they've developed, you know, better hotel accommodations in the countryside and better restaurants in Reykjavik, they've also developed some tours that are designed for people that don't quite have the level of riding skill that the traditional Icelander would have. So that in addition to the traditional long rides that are really rugged and really beautiful, there's now some shorter rides that offer pretty comfortable accommodations and are you know, 4 or 5 days of riding with the herd. So you still get the traditional aspect of riding with the herd, but you stay in comfortable guest houses and beds at night. And that, even though it's not 100% traditional, it's a little bit more enjoyable for Americans that are perhaps not used to quite right. that level of horse driving.
Let me ask, because I know if you need to do it. So, I mean, I hope you tell everyone that goes up there
yeah.
when they call your company that they have to do at least a 2 or 3 day trip on it, because it's totally indescribable, as we were talking about. But, you know, there's a couple of things I want to mention that I find interesting that I don't think most people realize, that you can actually snorkel in Iceland and you can kayak.
Yep.
And
we have
it's amazing.
There's a whole group of sort of, you know, Arctic adventure kind of folks that have taken some non-traditional sports and really adapted them to the interesting landscape that's there. There's in Þingvellir, which is the deepest lake in the country, where there's canyons in the lake that are like 300 feet deep, you can go snorkeling and scuba diving there, and as well as kayaking and, you know, fishing and that sort of thing. The water is unbelievably clear. It's glacial, but you have to wear a dry suit, of course, because it's, you know, being glacial, it's freezing cold. And just below the lake in the Kvitá River is really great whitewater rafting. People say that we don't have a huge amount of whitewater rafting experience, but we've had a bunch of our clients who've done it all over the world saying it's some of the best rafting in the world. Because it's great sort of, you know, big whitewater rocks and that sort of, and gullies and waves, and yet it's pretty secure. There's a chance to jump off a cliff into the water further down the river that's pretty interesting. And there's also kayaking in a few places. And again, kayaking is from Greenland, which is, you know, a couple hours away. Mm-hmm. But it works quite well on both some of the lakes and there's some sea kayaking. One of the fjords just north of Reykjavik has a wonderful, you know, sort of half-day kayak that the water is often fairly quiet. And if you want water that isn't so quiet, you can go further out into the out into the fjord. Mm-hmm. Also, if you go along the south coast, which a lot of people tend to do because it's close to Reykjavik, there out there is an really impressive array of adventure things, everything from beautiful walking, comfortable walking out to hot springs and waterfalls, and then more hiking and trekking, and then up and doing glacier walking. There's a glacier, mm-hmm. Sólheimajökull, that you can drive up to and then meet an outfitter, and they give you, you know, crampons and sticks and helmets, and off you go. And you can spend either a half day, people get out for a half day, or you can spend a couple of days up there climbing and exploring actually on the glacier. You have to do that with a guide. You really need somebody that mm-hmm. knows the landscape. But it's a thrill that's really unmatched in terms of, you know, most of the other stuff that you can do in other countries. Another mm-hmm. thing that we urge everybody to do is further out. If you look at a map of Iceland, in the southeast corner is a huge glacier called Vatnajökull, and that there's one of Iceland's national parks is sort of up on the glacier there, and that's got an awful lot of very good guided walks as well as some self-guided walks that you can, that they've, you know, they're they're quite safe, but pretty adventuresome and very beautiful. And then just a little bit beyond Vatnajökull is a place called Jökulsárlón. I don't know if you've been there, Jerry, but it's a...
I'm not sure. What is it? It doesn't sound familiar.
It's the glacial lagoon. Jökull, it means glacier, and Sárlón is lagoon.
And no, I've not been there, I don't think.
It's an unbelievable spot where the part of a tongue of Vatnajökull Glacier is calving, and there's this very large lagoon with enormous icebergs floating around in it. And you go out, you take a boat ride out in the middle of it, a duck boat, you know, one of the old, an old military boat. And it's an amphibious thing. It's really spectacular. It's quite otherworldly. There's often a bit of mist and fog because of the play between warm and hot. And it's just, you know, these blue icebergs and the quiet in the middle of the lagoon is pretty neat. So that's something that we sort of, if you're out in that direction, we sort of put that on everybody's kind of must-do list. You can actually actually touch the icebergs, which is pretty impressive.
Wow.
Yeah. It's, you know, sort of a, sometimes it's a little bit of a problem to pick how you're going to spend your time. There's also some interesting caving. If you're interested in lava caves, there's a... And that's developing a little bit as the outfitters get in and explore them more. We've been in a couple of them, and they're pretty impressive in terms of being, you know, you get right into the geology of the countryside. Those are often sort of a couple-hour trips, and they're, again, accessible from either Reykjavik or the south. There's a couple up in the north that are pretty cool as well. They're all kind of things you can include in either a driving tour or if you're going on a coach tour. Often they will include that sort of stuff. I think most of what, an awful lot of we send people to do is just some really impressive hiking where you can hike up into, there's a place in the south particularly, you can hike up a mountain to a valley with wonderful hot springs and, you know, sort of take your clothes off and get in your bathing suit and sit in this hot spring and soak for a couple hours. You can get there either on foot or on horseback. That sort of thing is really... pretty unique, and it's the whole south, the south part of Iceland is where there's an awful lot of geothermal activity, and that's the source of, we touched on earlier, the word, in English we call it geyser, and it's from the Icelandic name geysir for the particular valley where the, you know, the water is caught in underground fissures, and every so often it gets so hot that the pressure causes it to boil over and spout up. And Geysir was the original boiling water spout. And there's a whole nice little an area. It's a small area, but there's a bunch of geysirs in this in the valley called Hökkadalur. And that's something that is sort of, we put all that on everybody's must-see list just in terms of, it's not a huge, you don't need a huge amount of time. Makes for a very interesting hour because the geyser next door to the original geyser, about 50 feet away, it erupts about every 8 or 10 minutes, and it's really impressive, and you can see the whole process.
Well, before we go any farther on anything else, because I know you're going to have to go eventually, because you could keep you here for hours. This is fabulous. But I want to ask you one quick question, because over the last several decades, one of the most famous things that many of the world has heard of is volcanoes. Is it possible to see volcanoes, any of them actually working, I mean, spouting off or steaming or anything like that?
Yeah, you can go up to Mount Hekla, which is, they call it a little bit the tourist volcano because it erupts pretty much every 10 years, almost on schedule. A friend of ours with a guest house in the valley below, it says, you know, he's 70 years old and he's seen it erupt 7 times. But there's a couple of very nice ways. You can either do it yourself as part of a self-guided driving tour, or I think it's the kind of thing I'd actually recommend going with a tour guide with an outfitter and a super jeep, where you can hike up to the top and get quite close to it. Every so often when it erupts, of course, then it's a little bit off bounds, but you can get right up to the, you know, when it's not in eruption mode, you can get right up to the top of it, and it's pretty impressive. And there's a couple of other volcanoes. There's a volcano over on the east side that you can get to. But there's more impressively, there's a lot of very interesting volcanic craters that you can get to with an easy walk. There's Keras in the south and Askja up in the north that are both dramatic and beautiful and let you, you know, there's this very clear picture of Iceland's sort of geological past, or perhaps depending on when things are erupting. And, of course, there's a lot of caves usually associated with the volcanoes, too, and that's a little bit of where the caving and the lava tube activity comes in.
Well, Holly, we want to thank you so very, very much.
Oh, I'm sorry. I feel like I've talked too much, Jerry.
No, Holly.
No, that's why you're here.
Yeah.
We're not supposed to say a word. It's you.
Yeah.
And you said everything perfectly. I mean, we could have you back, and we could do totally different shows because – Iceland is one of those countries that we mentioned as small. I don't want to say this in one way, but it's like New Zealand. It's not like New Zealand. Well, some ways, but it's like New Zealand. You can go back to New Zealand 50 times and do different things, and the same with Iceland.
Yeah,
it
that's,
so
you
compact,
know, I,
but yet it's
yeah.
totally different world every time you go back.
Yeah, that's the nice thing about it for us is we go back there a lot, and there's always some aspect that's a little bit more revealed than you saw before, something new to see, something
mm-hmm.
different, because there is an awful lot of history, culture, action there that we just don't ever get tired of it. The other thing I didn't really take time to mention, but just 2 hours away is Greenland. And that's a world unto itself that's really fascinating as well.
Yeah.
Different. Totally different from Iceland.
Can we have you back and talk about Greenland?
Sure, I'd love to.
Yeah, that'd be great. Doing
for a whole show just on Greenland because
oh, no, that'd be great.
They're similar in some ways, but so different.
Sure. No, happy to because it's... particularly since you can now get there from Baltimore in the summer.
Right.
Yeah. There's a 6 week period in which you can. It's a 5 hour flight from Baltimore to Kangasuswak. So yeah, no, I'd be delighted to because it's quite interesting, and the contrast between the two countries is really fascinating.
Yeah, Holly, would you like to let our listeners know about your website where people can look at your information?
Oh, sure. Right. It's that's easy. It's Iceland Adventure. www.icelandadventure.com.
All right, okay.
And we have our tours on there, and there's a few other, you know, there's a fair amount of information about the country as well, and sort of the stuff that you'd expect to see about the land and the people and the horses and the various things to do.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the show. Be sure to listen to other great travel advice shows with Chris and Jerry at www.traveladviceshow.com.